Good afternoon, and thank you, Chris. When Chris called me and asked me to give a talk on soil potassium, my first response was, well, I haven't worked on soil potassium for 25 years. I actually worked on it during the first 10 years of my career, where we were looking at potassium status, particularly Virginia and Delaware soils. So I don't have a lot of fancy slides because all the slides that I had were the old 3x5 diazochrome slides, which I threw away many years ago. So I had to scan the papers to prepare the slides. But anyway, it's very nice to come back to this topic that was very dear to me for a long time and just basically give you a review of some of the work that was done on chemistry and mineralogy of potassium. And frankly, there hasn't been a lot of new research done in this area the last couple decades, in fact. So a lot of this will be sort of past history. But I want to start out with this quote from Albrecht in 1943, which I like very much because he talks about the important role of potassium, and certainly potassium has now become extremely important again, in large part because of economic factors. But he talks about the prevalence of it in the lithosphere, its soluble nature, its readiness to become insoluble. And then he says it's so nomadic that its performances in any particular situation are difficult to interpret. I don't know from a chemist standpoint if I quite agree that it's that difficult, but it is complex in that there are a lot of reactions that go on between the different forms of potassium. So let me just start out, and this is a review, I'm sure, but if we look at this first row elements plus some of the calcium, barium, and so forth, if one looks at the hydrated radius, one of the things that's sort of unique about potassium, which has a big impact upon its chemistry and mineralogy, is that it's relatively small. And so it has a size very similar to cesium and hydronium, which provides some unique opportunities in terms of its chemistry and mineralogy. If you look at the coordination number, it's quite high, so it's 8 to 12, which means that potassium is too large to fit into the tetrahedro-octahedral layers of clays, but it can, in many cases, fit into the inner layers, and we'll talk about some of these selective sites where the potassium could fit. I've given here some of the leading scientists. Many of these fortunately, they passed away, but they made major contributions in soil potassium. You'll probably recognize some of the names. Barshad at Berkeley, who did a lot of very nice work on mica. Philip Beckett, of course, did the famous quantity intensity studies at Oxford. Penming Wong, who was in Canada, he and I collaborated quite a bit on potassium chemistry and mineralogy. Of course, Marion Jackson did some fabulous work on mineralogy. Max Mortland also with particularly looking at weathering and kinetics of release. Oscar Talaboudin, who was at Rothamsted, did some beautiful work on thermodynamics of potassium exchange. C.I. Rich, I think, was probably contributed as much or anyone at Virginia Tech, who did some of the original work on potassium mineralogy related to wedge zones. And Duncan Scott at Iowa State, of course, the famous tetraphenyl boron work that he conducted. So potassium, I think one of the major reasons that it's grown in importance is the cost. And you can see that it's projected by 2020 that it may be $1,500 per ton. We're facing the same thing with phosphorus in terms of nutrient shortages. And I really like this quote. He didn't talk about potassium, but one of our former presidents way back in 1938 talked about the importance of soils and phosphorus and conservation being important to the security of the nation. So this was a book chapter that Penming and I published in 1985, and it was a result of a symposium held in Atlanta, sponsored by the Potash Phosphate Institute at that point, on the physical chemistry of potassium. And I'll just review a few things out of that. If we look at these equilibrium reactions, all of you know there are four major forms of potassium. Soil solution K, which of course is the type that is most readily available for plant uptake. Exchangeable K, which is also very available. But you can see that we have these dynamic equilibrium reactions between these phases, and so exchangeable potassium could convert to a fixed form, particularly in minerals like vermiculite, for example. And then, as I'll show you, in many soils, the bulk of the total potassium is in structural K. Potassium contained in micas and feldspars comprises a large part of the total potassium. But these equilibrium reactions are very important in determining the amount of potassium at any given time in solution. This is some of that very elegant work that C.I. Rich conducted in 19. This was published actually in the 60s. This is a review chapter in 1972. And what you see here is that in many soils, particularly these weathered micas, weathered vermiculites, in the interlayer position, the interlayer is not necessarily open the entire way. And so we have these regions like here, for example, that are called wedge zones, where potassium, hydronium, cesium are small enough they can fit, but large ions like calcium and magnesium cannot. And if, for example, if one uses ammonium acetate, which is a common extractant for exchangeable potassium, it should be able to remove potassium from those wedge zones because it fits. So then the question becomes, do you consider that really readily available for plants? And one can argue whether it is or isn't, depending on the ion that you use to extract it. And then you can see that we go to this slide. Again, this is a figure from Dr. Rich's work, that in many of these soils, in addition to having these wedge zones, we have a lot of these hydroxy-interlayered vermiculite. And they can serve as islands to prop open the interlayer so that then ions like potassium and ammonium can get back into that wedge zone space. And, of course, other regions that are totally collapsed where the potassium is basically fixed in a mineral form. Again, some work from C.I. Rich, which shows the effect of pH on extraction of potassium. And you'll notice that at the lower pHs, we tend to extract more potassium. A lot of that is because, again, we have more hydronium ions at those low pHs, which can exchange out potassium from the wedge zones. He found, interestingly, that magnesium chloride would exchange out a lot of potassium, and this is a combination of two factors. The chloride helped, and the hydronium helped reduce the pH so that the potassium could get back into the, or we could exchange the potassium, and the magnesium helped keep that interlayer propped open so that the small hydronium ion could get back into the wedge zone. So, actually, my work on potassium started when I was a graduate student at Virginia Tech in 1977. And they were having, of course, these soils are very sandy, coastal plain soils. They were noticing a lack of crop response. And they were trying to understand what is the cause of this crop response. Because the soils are very sandy, one would expect you'd have to add quite a bit of potassium to have a yield increase. And so the question was, is there something in the chemistry that there's potassium being supplied to the plant, or is it because potassium is leaching down into the subsoil horizons and could then, like corn roots, for example, extract that potassium? So this started a number of studies. These are data, these are old data, where we looked at three sites in eastern Virginia, and looked at different rates of potassium to see if we could see a yield response. And we really didn't see any significant yield response to potassium. If we look at the chemistry of these soils, you can see very sandy soils, but the clay mineralogy is quite interesting because we have a lot of these chloratized vermiculites, these intergrade clays where you can have these wedge zones where potassium could be exchanged in and out. Of course, a lot of kaolinite, a lot of gibbsite that shows the weathered nature of the soils. If we look at the potassium status, you can see a lot of the total K is in the primary mineral form. The exchangeable level, the non-exchangeable level, which would be nitric acid extractable K, is pretty low. But the total K, particularly in feldspars, was very high. But the question I may think, most people think, well, feldspars, you know, they're mineral phases of potassium. Would the release rate be quick enough to supply enough potassium for the plant to show a lack of response? When I went to the University of Delaware, because part of Delaware lies in the Atlantic coastal plain, they had the same issues. for many years, one of my colleagues had been had crops growing corn and had not shown any response to potassium for over a decade. And they were getting fairly good yields. So again, the question was, what's causing this lack of response? And here we can see even higher levels of total K, not a lot in the non-exchangeable, and you can see very high levels in the structural K, most of which was potassium feldspars. But again, it's sort of counterintuitive. Would soils of that high of feldspar, would they be releasing enough potassium to explain this lack of crop response? And if we look in the sand fraction, which most of the soil was, in many cases, over 90% sand, here's the total K levels, and you can see that the total K of the sand fraction was quite high. So the sand fraction contained a lot of total potassium, which was primarily in a feldspar form. We did similar studies there these are actually loamy sand soils. This is actually a silt loam soil more in the northern part of Delaware, where we looked again at crop yields, and often we didn't see a response to potassium on these soils. Looking here at the leaf tissue levels, here we actually split the potassium out into several applications to see, okay, would that have an impact upon crop growth? And you could see that the corn leaf tissue, while there was in some cases increases, there wasn't any consistent trend. So again, not a significant lack of response. So with that as sort of background, we understood what the potassium status of the soils were. But then the question was, could these soils be releasing enough potassium over time to supply the crop and explain the lack of response? So when I was a graduate student at Virginia Tech, we started working on kinetics. And in 1977, there was hardly any study on kinetics of soil chemical processes. I spent a sabbatical at UC Riverside with Gary Sposito, and during that sabbatical, I had a chance to visit with a number of the soil chemists at Riverside at that point. And so they talked to me about, you know, what are you doing in your research? And I said, well, I'm looking at kinetics. And one response was, well, kinetics are so fast, the reactions are so rapid, they're not important. So that was a little bit discouraging as an assistant professor, whether I was going down the wrong path. But I didn't quite believe that, because if you think of soils, we probably never reach an equilibrium. We're all always at some approaching a steady state. So I found this really wonderful quote from Walter Kelly's famous Cation Exchange in Soils book, published in 1948. The early work, you all remember J. Thomas Way, the founder of soil chemistry, and he had done these very elegant experiments and actually showed that the kinetics were very rapid. The actual exchange process was almost instantaneous. But Kelly made some very interesting points in this book back in 1948, when there was almost no kinetics work. And if you read toward the bottom of the quote, what he basically says is, well, I can understand Gedreutz and Way's conclusions, because the soils were fairly simple. They were kaolinitic, they were montmorillonitic. So the kinetics would be fast, but would that be the case in soils that are high in vermiculite and mica? Would the kinetics be slower, because you have these different sites of reactivity? You have exchange external sites, you have edge sites, you have wedge sites, and you have interlayer sites. And so, in fact, that stimulated work. 35 years later, we're still working on kinetics. We've shifted from potassium, but we find that kinetics is very important in controlling a lot of the reactions in soil. So this was a chapter that I published, Advances in Agronomy, on kinetics. And indeed, if we look at potassium chemistry again, you see not only are there these equilibrium reactions, they're kinetic reactions. And these kinetic reactions really control what's happening with potassium in soil. And so we have, you can see between the different phases, we have forward and backward rate coefficients, which one can measure. And so that made us very interesting to look at not only the exchangeable potassium, but we were particularly interested, do these soils that are so high in feldspar, are they able to release enough potassium that might be supplying the plant? So I did work as a PhD student in Virginia Tech, Here we're looking at soils, looking at the kinetics of potassium adsorption. You can see this typical biphasic behavior, fairly rapid reaction followed by slow reaction. If we looked at the desorption, however, the kinetics were much slower. So once the potassium was bound, to try to release it, the kinetics were quite slower, which again is related to this complex mineralogy where you get fixation of potassium and slower release. And we can typically plot the data, first order kinetics, and get pretty good relationships. When I went to the University of Delaware, I was very fortunate as my first graduate student to have this guy in the photo, Philip Jardine, who unfortunately passed away earlier this year. And we started a number of studies on potassium exchange in soils, looking at kinetics. And Phil did these fairly simple experiments, but sort of corroborated actually what Walter Kelly had thought. And if we looked at potassium adsorption just on minerals like kaolinite, montmorillonite, and vermiculite, what you see is with these simple minerals like kaolinite and montmorillonite, the kinetics are fairly quick. But when we go to soils that have a lot of mica and vermiculite, the kinetics are very slow indeed. So this is looking at adsorption. So we have these rapid sites that are filled, and then you start getting diffusion into these interlayer sites, which causes the kinetics to be quite slow. And we can again plot the data, first order kinetics, but again you see these sort of biphasic processes. So then we decided to look at soils. Okay, we looked at minerals. What happens in soils? And what in soils, because you have these multiple exchange sites, this is looking at adsorption at three different temperatures. We can see, again, a biphasic reaction. And so we thought about how can we sort of prove what's happening rapidly. Is this adsorption, for example, on external planar sites? And then do we get this slow adsorption diffusion into interlayer sites? And so we applied a polymer, acetyl trimethyl ammonium bromide, which only impacts these external sites. And when we did that, this is the CTAB treated, you can see that we got basically one big slope, which shows that the CTAB was basically covering up these external sites, which were the ones that where we got the rapid kinetics, and then the slow kinetics was due to diffusion into these interlayer spaces. The same thing here, we're looking at potassium desorption. You can see these sort of biphasic processes. And we can again plot data. This is a Matapique soil. A lot of data plots fairly nicely, first order kinetics, but in many cases we have to apply simultaneous first-order reactions to capture these mineralogical effects. The other thing that we did was, in order to get some insights on the mechanism and whether diffusion was an important process, these are data that Phil collected where we looked at multiple temperatures. What is the effect of temperature on the exchange process? And we could calculate adsorption and desorption rate coefficients. And then basically using the Arrhenius equation, one could calculate an energy of activation. And if you look at these numbers, they're very small. So what that says is that these reactions are very diffusion controlled, not surprising, because we're getting potassium getting into these interlayer sites, wedge sites, which slows down the kinetics, and these values are quite low. Also, we did thermodynamic measurements, and these enthalpies of formation are very negative, which says that there's a lot of strong binding of potassium on the soil. So then, we still wanted to answer this question, do these soils that are very sandy and have high potassium total levels, a lot in the sand fraction, can they release enough potassium to perhaps supply the plant that might help explain the lack of response? So this is some work that Harris Martin did where we looked at two sandy soils, and we looked, in this case, the release of non-exchangeable K. So nitric acid, which is a common extractant for non-exchangeable potassium, was used, and you can see that fairly rapid process, but then we get this continued slow release of potassium. So these soils are able to supply amounts of potassium over long periods of time. This is some data, another student, where we looked at a hydrogen resin and oxalic acid, and again, you can see these soils are releasing potassium from sand fractions. And here we actually separated out the sand fraction to see, can the individual sand fractions, for example, coarse, medium, and fine, can they be releasing potassium again, which could explain this lack of release. And you can see, particularly with the hydrogen resin, we're getting fairly significant amounts of potassium that's coming out of the different sand fractions, even the coarse sand fraction, and particularly the fine sand fraction. So, just to end, am I still on time? Yeah. Okay. Just to end, I did go back and I did a lot of searching to see what new information have we learned about chemistry and mineralogy of potassium. And I may be wrong, but there's not a lot of additional data. I think once we got into more environmental issues, potassium sort of went back to the backdrop. It wasn't viewed as very important. But it is a very important element. It's very important for crop growth. I think with the cost of fertilizer now, there's a lot of interest in it and a lot more we can do. And so anyway, I thank you for your attention. Yeah, I think so. Because if we look at that nomenclature, those soils all fit into a particular siliceous type, and so they're remarkable, actually. I mean, I would have never believed that they had that capacity. And in one case, this colleague, I think he had plots for 15 years, and we never saw any significant response. So they're very unique because you know they're 80-90% sand, and most people think that the feldspars are not very, but they're quite weathered. In fact, when we did SEM images, you could see these etch pits. You could see they were quite weathered, and so they're just continually supplying potassium. But I think the classification could almost look at that and predict, at least in those coastal plains. I'm not so familiar with other Midwestern soils and some of those.
Can you just hold any other questions for Don until after?